Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. If you have ever experienced pain while having sex, weight gain from a contraceptive, or found it difficult to feel sexy after a cancer diagnosis and treatment, today's articles are for you. Often I think people mistake these issues as being particular only to women, but we will read about birth control for men and about research into the effect of lavender and tea tree essential oils on estrogen and testosterone. And last I heard, often men and women participate in sexual experiences together. So here are some articles that I've lumped under the title Men, Women, and Sex. And we start out with one clearly titled Sex Hurts, Help. And this is written by Jen Gunter and published on January 31st, 2018 in the New York Times. It is a relatively common myth that penises can be too large. As a professional, I can assure you they generally are not. From time to time, I receive a query from a girlfriend wondering if her potential new partner is perhaps too large. One of the perks of having an obstetrician and gynecologist as a friend is you can ask everything and get informed answers. I remind them that vaginas have been finely tuned by hundreds of thousands of years of evolution to stretch. If they are interested, and if this gentleman is a safe choice, personally and medically, then break out the lubricant and have a ball. If it hurts, stop and give me a call. Not immediately, but perhaps the next day. It is also not uncommon for me to hear about penis size from people I barely know. Once I was out for dinner with my future ex-husband and some people I'd never met. When the opportunity presented itself, the woman turned to me just as I was taking a mouthful of pasta and said, "We can't have sex. His penis is just too big." It was one of those record scratch freeze frame moments, because I can almost guarantee that this man did not miss his calling in the pornography industry. If they both want to believe it is huge, great. But the truth is, they probably do not have a size problem. They probably more likely have a medical condition known as dyspareunia. "Does it feel like he's hitting a wall?" I asked. They both looked at me as if I were psychic. I am not. Women for whom tampons and sex are painful because the vagina feels too tight or small almost always have a condition called vaginismus. This means the muscles of the pelvic floor that surround the vagina are inappropriately taut. Typically, these muscles relax with sexual stimulation and then contract rhythmically with orgasm. When they are tight, it can cause pain with sex, a fit issue, and even pain or difficulty with orgasm. Sometimes the pain can be worse after sex. This woman I met briefly is no different than the patients I've been seeing for 25 years. She has pain with sex, she had told multiple providers, and not only had she never been offered a treatment, but she also had never even been given a diagnosis. The best modern medicine has left her with is internet mythology. And not even vaginal mythology, but penis mythology. This enrages me. And here we have an essay piece from the Washington Post written by Elizabeth Kiefer and published on March 23, 2018, titled, "A Birth Control Pill for Men Includes a Side Effect That Has Frustrated Women for Decades." It's been more than a century since Margaret Sanger opened the first birth control clinic in the United States, and nearly 60 years since the first oral contraceptive was approved by the FDA. In 1965, the Supreme Court gave married couples the right to use birth control under the landmark court case Griswold v. Connecticut. It took until 1972 for birth control to become legalized for use among all citizens of the United States, whether they were married or not. Since then, more options have emerged. IUDs, the Depo-Provera shot, the sponge, the ring, the patch. Birth control today is still far from perfect, but many rightly contend that access to the pill was the match that lit the fire of women's liberation that is still burning today. This week marks a new addition to the annals of contraceptive history, dimethandrolone undecanoate, a potential new birth control pill for men, is being touted as the best hope for a non-permanent male contraceptive option yet. Developed with funding from the National Institutes of Health by a team at the University of Washington, the formula is a tweaked version of previous failed attempts. While it comes with caveats, the pill must be taken with food to be effective. Tests showed that usage had slight negative effect on cholesterol levels and over time might raise the risk of heart disease. Right now, the drug has shown itself to be safe for short-term use. The next step? A trial that will show whether the pill decreases sperm production, followed by another test that will measure its efficacy in control groups of married and long-term partnered men. But dimethandrolone undecanoate also comes with a side effect that has been frustrating women for decades. It caused men to gain weight, a fact that couldn't help but make this woman wonder whether that will be the latest reason that the responsibility for preventing pregnancy will continue to rest largely on the shoulders of women. The truth is, while the advent and evolution of birth control has fundamentally reshaped women's place and participation in culture, for that to happen, women had to be willing to take on a certain level of risk and potential downsides. Enovid, the first brand of birth control, which contained more hormones than necessary to prevent pregnancy, was linked to an increased, though rare, likelihood of heart attack and stroke. It took a decade for scientists to recognize those risks and reformulate a pill with a lower dose of hormones that was just as effective. In the interim, for some women, the costs, weight gain, water retention, nausea, dizziness, breast tenderness, headaches, vomiting, outweighed the benefits. For others, at a time when an abortion was either illegal or difficult to obtain, the downsides were worth it if it meant not getting pregnant. It took congressional hearings in 1970 to compel the FDA to include in each pack of pills a package insert detailing the potential side effects, a practice the American Medical Association initially opposed. The AMA contended that an insert would undermine a doctor's authority with his patients. At the time, female physicians made up less than 10% of the field, which might in part be an explanation for why it took so long for women's complaints to be taken seriously. Years later, the Delcon Shield IUD would become another example of a birth control product ultimately deemed to pose too high a risk to women's health, after hundreds of thousands of women sued the makers for knowingly marketing a product that increased the potential of life-threatening pelvic infections. It took decades for IUDs to recover as a preferred option for American women, and today women still have reason to be concerned that they don't have all the health facts. Then there's the stress that women have endured, largely on their own, not just because of the risk factors, but also because of the burden of responsibility to prevent pregnancy itself. This is unlikely to ever appear on a package insert, but taking a pill every day, or getting a shot every month, or changing an IUD every few years takes planning, access to medical care, and financial resources. At a time when women's reproductive rights are under siege and public health resources such as Planned Parenthood are fighting to keep funding, many women are finding their options strained. It's mentally draining, all this flux that could leave women in the lurch, which is another weight on our shoulders that often goes unacknowledged. Add standards of beauty and the pressure to maintain a certain size and shape to the mix, and it's not particularly surprising that women are twice as likely to have an anxiety disorder as men. Will dimethandrolone undecanoate make it to market and help rebalance the scale a bit? I, for one, am hopeful. I like the idea of giving women and their partners more choices for family planning. I like the idea that men would have more power and more accountability when it comes to the prevention or the pursuit of pregnancy. I like the idea of a culture in which men can't allege that a woman trapped them into fatherhood because they too had the ability to make an autonomous birth control choice beyond a condom, where men also have to weigh whether their choice of birth control is worth the effect it could have on their physique, and whether that potential downside might make them a less desirable sexual partner. I would never wish a birth control product on men that was anything less than optimal. I am grateful that men will benefit from the medical advancements and knowledge gained since the first oral contraceptives were brought to market 58 years ago. But I also wonder whether the tip of the scale, both literal and otherwise, might be a good reminder for men who've had the luxury of a particular kind of privilege and freedom that women have been pulling this extra weight all along. Now we go back to the New York Times, where Susan Gubar wrote Sex After Cancer, and this was published January 18, 2018. At diagnosis, quite a few cancer patients spy Eros rushing out the door. I know I did. For some, eroticism vanishes during or after treatment. Anhedonia, the inability to feel pleasure, can afflict both men and women with cancer. We often get more help from one another than from the medical specialists who are beginning to address this challenge. It can be difficult to experience desire if you don't love but fear your body, or if you cannot recognize it as your own. Surgical scars, lost body parts and hair, chemically induced fatigue, radiological burns, nausea, hormone-blocking medications, numbness from neuropathies, weight gain or loss, and anxiety hardly function as aphrodisiacs. At 46, the youngest member of my cancer support group put it best, an existential crisis is not sexy. Although her physicians offered no advice, she eventually attempted to foster a renewed sex life, if only for the caring partner who saw her through treatment. Sex and Cancer, a new book by Dr. Saketh R. Guntupalli, a gynecologic cancer specialist, and Marianne Karenk, sets out to help women with gynecologic or breast cancer. Dr. Guntupalli and Ms. Karenk labor mightily to provide scientific evidence for an insight some might consider predictable. We found that sex was less pleasurable for women after cancer, and that all types of sexual activity, oral, vaginal, and anal, decreased after cancer. In patches of ponderous prose, their book describes the ways in which treatment inhibits romance. More informative are the sections of Sex and Cancer in which the authors explain what people can do to ensure that the emperor of all maladies will not rule and wreck their relationships. First and foremost, Dr. Guntupalli and Ms. Karenk urge readers not to slap a dysfunction label on your love life just because you read something about what is normal or average. This is precisely the advice that prostate cancer patients also receive in self-help manuals. The capacious term sex should not be conflated with penetration or intercourse, according to Dr. Guntupalli and Ms. Karenk. There is no dysfunction if both members of the couple are happy with the level and style of intimacy they enjoy. Kissing, hand-holding, cuddling, caressing, and massaging bond couples by kindling arousal and ardor. The authors do not mention the useful word frottage, which comes from the French for rubbing or friction. It neatly bundles together many forms of stimulation that prompt tenderness and excitement. With a therapist or on their own, partners can try sensate focus exercises that involve them in exploratory touching without the pressure to achieve a goal like orgasm. Pelvic floor exercises, vibrators, techniques for dealing with scar tissue and restricted range of motion, dilators as well as lubricants. Dr. Guntupalli and Ms. Karenk tackle these specifics to encourage survivors to redefine sex after cancer as a sensual source of delight in a range of activities. To illustrate this point, they tell the story of Alice, a 49-year-old ovarian cancer patient who undergoes a total pelvic exenteration, the surgical removal of the bladder, urethra, rectum, anus, vagina, and cervix. She awakens with a permanent colostomy and a urinary diversion. She must wear two bags to collect feces and urine. To her dismay, gone are her cute thongs, replaced by granny panties. She buys an ostomy belt to protect and hide the bags, as well as a black negligee. But she sobs when her husband's embraces bring home the realization that there is no way to have normal sex. After he reassures her that they can be creative, they begin getting ideas by visiting what she calls naughty stores and then exploring every possible way to enjoy themselves together. Not facing such extreme physiological impairments, the youngest member of my support group nevertheless found herself less easily aroused and less orgasmic. Her explanation of how she cultivated the art of desire strikes me as illuminating for women and also for men. She uses exercise to appreciate her body's tremendous resilience, acknowledges that she has anatomically, psychologically, and hormonally changed, experiments with solo sex and also extended foreplay with her partner, and samples the shared stimulation of movies, concerts, and travels to create a sense of closeness. Since her marital bed had been her sick bed, she refurbished the bedroom with sensory stimulants. It now promotes joy in her partner's life and in hers as well. When Eros disappears, books and conversations can help couples prepare to welcome the god's return. As the poet Marianne Moore once put it, in an entirely different context, whatever the problem, we must elude the sense of being trapped, even if all one can say to oneself is, if not now, later. For many people, better later than never. Yet this is not the case for everyone. I realized when my contemporary and fellow academic Nancy K. Miller responded to my request for input on the issue of sex after cancer. In her 70s, she has, like me, managed the disease for years. With precisely the exasperation I associate with the intimacy I crave, she shot back, "You expect me to remember sex?" My laughter was a total turn-on as I bathed in the bliss of cherishing my friend's candor. We go to the Washington Post, and written by Aaron Blakemore, published on March 11, 2018, "Ask Me About My Uterus," insists that doctors take women's pain seriously. Something was stabbing Abby Norman from the inside. As she took what she would later call the worst shower of her life, the college sophomore experienced a wave of excruciating abdominal pain. It would take years for doctors to take that pain seriously. Even as her body withered, her hair turned gray, and she dropped out of college because of her precarious health, Norman's providers insisted she was imagining things. Eventually, she set out on her own investigation of her symptoms, scouring through medical literature for answers. Ask Me About My Uterus, subtitled A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain, and published by Nation Books this month, reveals Norman's struggle for a diagnosis, endometriosis, and a meditation on how healthcare providers can ignore women's pain. Endometriosis, in which the uterine lining grows outside the uterus, is thought to affect more than 11% of American women between ages 15 and 44, yet it's underdiagnosed and little understood. Women with endometriosis aren't the only ones whose pain and other physical symptoms are underestimated by doctors. Women report more chronic pain than men, and when they report acute pain, women are more likely to be prescribed sedatives than pain medications. Even when they do receive diagnoses, women report being dismissed as overly emotional when they insist on appropriate treatment. For years, scholars and patients have cried bias, but physical pain is often paired with a fight to be taken seriously by medical providers. Norman, now a science writer, articulates her own struggles with clarity and calmness. She weaves in historical context about the diagnosis, treatment, and perception of women in medicine, from the myth of hysteria to cultural perceptions about women's pain tolerance and propensity for female troubles. In a way, Ask Me About My Uterus is an extension of Norman's terrible shower, a torrent of disconcerting information about the continued struggle to understand and value women's bodies. Norman hopes to use that information to destroy misconceptions and pave the road for change. It is my sincerest hope, she writes, that some of what is in this book will no longer be applicable by the time it's in your hands. And we get to, this time it is from CBC Health Second Opinion, written by Kelly Crow, and this was published on March 24th, 2018. The title is, Can We Say Vagina in a Headline? New Name and New Controversy About a Menopausal Condition. A controversial study in JAMA Internal Medicine this week showed that a placebo worked just as well as an estrogen hormone tablet to relieve the most bothersome symptoms of a menopausal condition that used to be called vulvovaginal atrophy. That's before it was renamed to make it more media-friendly. Now the condition is called GSM, or genitourinary syndrome of menopause. The term vulvovaginal atrophy really was problematic, said Cheryl Kingsburg, president of the North American Menopause Society, one of two groups that voted to change the name. She said TV and radio programs are squeamish about saying vaginal on the air. There are many media stations that will say, you can't say the word vagina, Kingsburg said, adding that women also didn't like the word atrophy. Menopausal women were really taken aback and offended and bothered by the fact that they were told their vagina was atrophying, said Kingsburg. No matter what it's called, women are often confused about how to relieve postmenopausal symptoms that can include vaginal dryness and painful sex, called dyspareunia in medical literature. One option is prescription estrogen in the form of a vaginal tablet. On the product monograph that comes with the drug, there's a warning about potential risks of estrogen, although most doctors insist the medication is safe because it's not widely absorbed by the body. But now there's evidence that a placebo and an over-the-counter gel work just as well as the hormone tablets. That was a surprise to us, said study author Dr. Carolyn Mitchell from the Massachusetts General Hospital. These results were a surprise to many people. Our results suggest that neither prescribed vaginal estradiol tablet nor over-the-counter vaginal moisturizer provides additional benefit over placebo vaginal tablet and gel in reducing postmenopausal vulvovaginal symptoms, the study concluded. It's encouraging, because everyone had some improvement, even with a super cheap intervention, said Mitchell, adding that the prescription estrogen treatments can be expensive. In Canada, the drug costs about $175 for the first 3 months and $130 every 3 months after that. It is intended to be taken long-term. But Dr. Jennifer Blake, CEO of the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada, said the study needed to be longer than 3 months to test the efficacy of the estrogen pill. The pill, we know it needs 3 months to be fully effective, she said, adding that she wasn't surprised that the placebo also showed results. You would get symptomatic relief from using any kind of cream or lubricant, she said. And we go to the BBC News of March 18th, 2018, for more evidence that essential oils make male breasts develop. A suspected link between abnormal breast growth in young boys and the use of lavender and tea tree oils has been given new weight after a study found 8 chemicals contained in the oils interfere with hormones. Gynecomastia is rare and there's often no obvious cause, but there have been a number of cases linked to use of these essential oils. The American study found that key chemicals in the oils boost estrogen and inhibit testosterone. Not everyone will have the same reaction to an essential oil. The plant-derived oils are found in a number of products, such as soaps, lotions, shampoos, and hairstyling products. They're also popular as alternative cleaning products and medical treatments. Lead researcher J. Tyler Ramsey from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences in North Carolina suggested caution when using the oils. Our society deems essential oils as safe. However, they possess a diverse amount of chemicals and should be used with caution because some of these chemicals are potential endocrine disruptors. A growing number of reported cases of male gynecomastia have coincided with topical exposure to the oils. After they stopped using the products, the symptoms subsided. A previous study by Dr. Kenneth Korak, who was also co-investigator for this study, found that lavender and tea tree oil had properties that competed with or hindered the hormones that control male characteristics, which could affect puberty and growth. The new study looked at 8 key chemicals from the hundreds that make up the oils. 4 of the tested chemicals appear in both oils, and the others were in either oil. They were tested on human cancer cells in the laboratory to measure the changes. The researchers found all 8 demonstrated varying degrees of promoting estrogen and/or inhibiting testosterone properties. Lavender oil and tea tree oil pose potential environmental health concerns and should be investigated further, said Mr. Ramsey. Many of the chemicals tested appeared in at least 65 other essential oils, which is of concern, he added. Professor Ewan Hughes, Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Cambridge, said the findings have confirmed why an individual using such oils containing these chemicals may develop breast tissue. The anti-male hormone effects are rather unexpected, and it is not possible to comment further without the data. Of course, not everyone exposing themselves to such oils has adverse effects, so it is possible there are particular individuals who may be more sensitive to the effects of the chemicals or perhaps are using the products in excess. The concentration dose to which the cells are exposed may not be equivalent to exposure in humans. There is a complex relationship between estrogen, testosterone, and other hormones in the body that cannot be replicated in these experiments. He called for further large studies. At present, there is insufficient evidence to support the concept that exposure to lavender and tea tree oil containing products cause gynecomastia in children, and further epidemiological and experimental studies are required. That sounds like a pretty safe thing to say. And to help us end here today, I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Please stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig. And I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.